listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and welcome to Football in Europe. I'm Rob Daly. This is your weekly European football podcast. Joining me, as always, is Chris Parrott. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Well, it was a bumper weekend across Europe, Rob. Controversial end to the big game in Italy, Juventus against Milan. We'll have a look at the Spanish title race, which Barcelona had a great week in Europe, not so domestically. Mark Rodden, one of my favourite times of the season, guides us through the ridiculous Belgian playoff system. And we'll discuss the huge fallout in the French media from PSG's disastrous Champions League exit. Oh, and by the way, Memphis Depay scored from the halfway line.
I think that's the goal of the season.
I agree.
Already. I've never seen a goal like that.
So normally, if a guy scores from the halfway line, he's facing the goal, isn't he? And he sees where the goalkeeper is and he goes for goal and it's still incredible. Whereas Memphis Depay, when he picked up the ball, had his back to where the goal was, swivelled and hooked it over the goalkeeper. It was nuts.
Yeah, OK, that's my goal of the set. I'd be amazed if something beats that. We will talk about Memphis Depay in a moment because it looks like he is starting to deliver as... We knew he would. I mean, we know he's a great player. Let's talk about that in a moment, though, because you've been sending in your tweets at FIE Podcast as well, your European football highlights of the weekend. By the way, Archie Rintutt of BT Sport is going to be joining us to talk about Leverkusen's new head coach. I was at the Bayer Leverkusen game on Friday, so we're going to hear some of the sights and sounds of the Bayer Arena. And Archie's going to guide us through all the latest Bundesliga news. Shall I read out some of the highlights of the week, Chris?
Yes, definitely.
Scott Taylor says his highlight of the week, Scott Taylor UK on Twitter, first time that Luis Suarez has scored for Barca and they've lost, a crazy stat considering how many goals he has scored for them.
Yes.
He also mentions a stunning goal from Memphis Depay. We'll talk about Barcelona's shock defeat as well. Tommy C says his highlight of the weekend, along with Adam Summerton went for this as well, Grenier's assist. I've not seen that. I need to check that out. Grenier's assist, Hertha beating Dortmund, apart from Mitchell Weiser's incredible play acting, and the Memphis Depay second goal as well. Thank you so much to everyone who has tweeted in this week. Chris, I commentated on Hertha against Dortmund at the weekend.
Yeah, and again, it looked like Hertha's season, after starting so well, was beginning to be on the wane, but... they beat them, and I guess that opens up the whole Champions League race again behind Bayern and Leipzig, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, we're going to get into this with Archie, but, you know, Hertha, I think it's three teams fighting it out for two spots. I think Dortmund will get one, and then it's Hoffenheim and Hertha ready for the Champions League. I would like to see Hertha in the Champions League again. It would be great for the Berlin club to be back in it.
Instead of who? Not Dortmund.
Oh, no. Dortmund, Leipzig and Bayern will be in the Champions League, I think, and then it'll be Hoffenheim or Hertha, one or the other. So it might be Julian Nagelsmann, maybe.
That's true.
But I did commentate on the game with Peter Lovenkrantz, who told me this brilliant story from his time at Schalke. Shall I tell you about
it? Yeah, definitely.
So he at the time, he said Manuel Neuer was third choice when he first joined Schalke, coming through the youth team, and eventually he became first choice, obviously. And I was saying, like, I was saying to Peter, did you know he was going to be, like, the best goalkeeper in the world, you know, or one of the top three, you could argue. And he said he was so good, you knew he was going to be exceptional. And that at one point, Schalke based their tactics around Neuer.
Really?
So because Neuer is so good with his feet and he could throw the ball over the halfway line without it bouncing, if they were defending a set piece or particularly a corner, Lovenkrantz and another winger would stand on the edge of the penalty area. And as the guy was running up to take the corner, Lovenkrantz says he'd turn around, ignore the man he was marking, and run, like full-on sprint as fast as he could.
In case Neuer gets the ball.
Yeah, and more likely than not, Neuer will get it because he's so good in the air. So Neuer gets it, he pings it out, and he would easily pick out, Lovenkrantz or the winger on the other side.
And actually, Lovenkrantz is the perfect guy that you would want turning around, sprinting up the other end of the pitch.
Yeah, he was so quick. And he said they scored so many goals from the counter-attack that season that teams eventually worked out that that's how they were playing with Neuer in goal. So they'd leave two players back on the halfway line to stop the counter, taking them away from the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
How clever is that?
That's really... Did you ask him if you got to the stage when you, like, if they needed a goal, they'd boot the ball out themselves for a corner? just to try and
Yeah, this is our best chance of scoring. I didn't ask him that. There's lots to get through this week. Paris Saint-Germain losing to Barcelona.
Losing?
That was good.
Losing is one way of saying it, isn't it? They were. Like, Barcelona, yes, were brilliant, but how bad were Paris Saint-Germain?
They got a win against Lorient on Sunday night.
Which actually...
But the fallout has been catastrophic for a result I would call maybe the most embarrassing European club football defeat since Milan against Liverpool in 2005. I think to Germany losing to Brazil in terms of international football at the World Cup.
I think it's... You know what? I think it's worse because I think in a final, these things can happen. And yes, they were 3-0 up. But everything went against them, you could say. I think losing a 4-0 lead. I think it's worse than Milan losing that final, because losing a 4-0 lead had never happened, and then having scored the goal, they were through again. So they almost managed to contrive to lose twice within a 95-minute football match. And the goals that they gave away were, I mean, if you saw that in a Sunday league, a couple of them, definitely the second, you'd be disappointed. Not in the round of 16 in the Champions League. And why didn't Di Maria pass to Cavani at 3-1?
That's who you text me. You would live it.
If you're going to be a winning football club on the European stage, look at how Bayern dismantled Arsenal, right? There are a couple of times when their players were through and they passed for a tap-in instead of going for glory. And they were 5-1 up after the first leg. You know that Barcelona...
Yeah, just brutal.
You know, you just get the job done. And, I mean, I can't... I'm sure Unai Emery must have watched it back 100 times. And I think he can look at his team as opposed to, as much as himself, look at his team. I think he was let down by some very, very ordinary performances.
Okay, let's dissect the aftermath, because obviously that game was last week. But the rumbling effects have gone on to this week. Mm. The PSG president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, in an interview with Le Parisien, refused to condemn the referee, pointing to the Luis Suarez penalty in particular, I think, the one he won for 5-1. And he says the team should have managed the game better, but that it won't derail the PSG project. And I quite like that response. I quite like how measured that is.
That is measured.
But Chris, there's a problem between L'Équipe, the big French sports daily, and Paris Saint-Germain, which has notoriously had a leaky dressing room in terms of stories for years. Do you want to break down this huge fallout which led to Paris Saint-Germain calling out L'Équipe and actually saying, we do not understand the agenda of the newspaper in publishing lies about the team? So do you want to run through this?
Yeah, well, so I think there have been two incidents. First of all, once Paris Saint-Germain arrived back, in the early hours, there was an incident outside the airport where they landed, involved a supporter allegedly being hit by Thiago Motta's car and generally fans heckling the players. That was reported, widely reported, and exactly what happened we still don't know. There is a police investigation. Then on Friday, there was another report in L'Équipe claiming that Matuidi and Verratti were a nightclub in Barcelona in the early hours of Monday morning. Now, that is a very serious allegation, given what happened, what would have been less than 24 hours on from them being in that nightclub. PSG says that simply isn't true, and released a statement saying, what is L'Équipe's agenda by publishing such lies? You know, we don't have the facts, so we don't know what has happened. But clearly, that is going to be an argument, a debate, which is going to go on. And, you know, you wonder what it will mean for how L'Équipe and Paris Saint-Germain work together, if you like, in the future. It is an extraordinary fallout. What I would say is I'm not surprised by it, Rob, because, you know, you mentioned there about Al-Khelaifi saying this won't derail the PSG project. The project is to win the Champions League. They have stated that. They sacked Laurent Blanc, who won every domestic trophy because they couldn't get beyond the quarterfinals. So is it proportionate? In a way, the amount of media coverage, I think, is. I'm not saying if L'Équipe has been making stuff up. If they have, then clearly that is unacceptable. However, is it a surprise that there has been such a fallout? I don't think it is, because PSG's whole model is around winning this competition. and they've just been utterly humiliated with the heaviest ever second leg defeat in terms of a comeback.
Let's read some of the reaction to this. So there's still this ongoing... There's stuff in L'Equipe even, I think, this morning as we record this, talking about Paris Saint-Germain. Siddharth Tiwari has tweeted us at FIE Podcast to say, the end of Emery. I mean, we can't know until the end of the season. I still think the 4-0 win against Barcelona was the best performance I've seen from any team this season in any competition. I was just blown away by how good they were, which only makes the second leg completely inexplicable. And if anyone can find it, there was this interview that Matuidi, Verratti, Draxler and Meunier did, where they're on French TV and they just sat in a group of four eating dinner and they're just chatting. And they talk about the need for focus ahead of the game. It's a really great bit of, and very interesting to watch in hindsight. It's a real insight into their mindset going into the game. They're not being interviewed by anyone. Mm. They're just chatting amongst each other. I was going to put a bit in the podcast, but we'd have to dub it over, blah, 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 too complicated. So go find that yourself. It's got subtitles and everything. Absolutely invaluable insight. Because they needed to play Lorient at the weekend, probably. Needed a team they could beat. What psychological damage does that result and the fallout from it do to Paris Saint-Germain for the rest of the season?
Oh, time will tell, won't it? I actually think, yeah, Lorient were a good, you know, had they come up against a Monaco or a Nice or somebody, you know, it probably was about the perfect game for them. I think it will say a lot about the Paris Saint-Germain players and about just how much respect Unai Emery has about how they go about now the rest of the season, because absolutely they now need to go and win Ligue 1, which they're going to have a heck of a battle to do against the sides who have improved so incredibly this season, really. But I also think you have to look ahead now to the next time Paris Saint-Germain are in the knockout stages, because I'll come back to it. This isn't me saying it or you saying it. This is the president. This is... How many times have we heard our aim is to win the Champions League? It was one of the first things they said when they took over. So next time they're back in a knockout pressure environment, all of this is going to come back again and again. Yeah. And it's not going to go away until they get beyond the quarterfinals, beyond the semifinals, and probably eventually win it.
OK, let's run through a couple of other stories from France from the weekend. Let's start with Monaco, 2-1 winners over Bordeaux, Kylian Mbappe scoring again. The 18-year-old has now scored 16 and assisted 10 in 30 games this season. That's more goals than Martial had at that point in his Monaco career. And Archie Rintat, who's coming up on the show later, tweeted a brilliant picture of Mbappe as a younger kid with lots of pictures of Ronaldo, maybe 10 or 15 over his bed. So I think we know who his hero is. Saint Wenger said he tried to sign him in the summer.
Yeah, well, I think lots of people try to sign him in the summer. It's not like I think many people...
He does this, doesn't he, Wenger? I mean,
as if he's the only person who knew who Mbappe was in the summer. There's also a great YouTube video I saw of Mbappe banging in a couple of free kicks when he was 9. Honestly,
I've not seen that.
Honestly,
Chris, can you tweet that out from the account? I've not seen that.
Yeah, I will
do.
And it is, he's taken a free kick. It's like you'd dream of doing it. There's like, you know, there's the four mannequins and he just whacks it in the top corner. And he's about 3 foot tall.
All right, Nice, by the way, drew 2-2 at the weekend with Koth coming from 2-0 down. Balotelli did score in that game. They're 13 points clear of Lyon, who are fourth in the race for Champions League football. Lyon smashing in goals. You would have seen them score 4 against Roma last week. Memphis Depay got 2 of them against Toulouse for Lyon's win. Memphis Depay scored 2 for Lyon in the 4-0 win against Toulouse. And, you know, he's right in form. And, I mean, we've already talked about it. But what a goal. I mean, just ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. You always felt like it was... You know, we talked about the going to Ligue 1 to sort of rejuvenate your career, and it's becoming the league, I think, to do that. And you always thought, yeah, that Lyon would be a good club to go to if he can, you know, himself can begin to produce the performances we know he's capable of. But Lacazette is, you know, his goal against Roma was terrific, wasn't it? I think they're going to, you know, Champions League qualification is too far off, but they are serious Europa League contenders.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Well, that was the sound of Felix Vietvoudt, the Bremen goalkeeper, making a last-minute save to deny Umut Toprak from the penalty spot. You could probably hear them chanting, Vietvoudt, Vietvoudt. I was at the Bayer Arena on Friday night for Bayer Leverkusen against Werder Bremen, the home team with a brand new head coach. Joining us to talk about Leverkusen and all of the Bundesliga is BT Sports' Archie Rintat. Archie, thanks for coming on the show as always, mate.
Hi there, Rob. Pleasure to be with you as ever.
Are you sure you're up to scratch? You've been skiing, so I'm worried you're not at 100%.
Don't you worry. I've spent the majority of my weekend poring over editions of Kicker magazine and Sportbild and watching hours worth of Bundesliga highlights. So I say I'm fully up to date. I guess you'll find that out in the next few minutes.
Let's find out. Okay, let's start with Bayer Leverkusen. First of all, they changed their manager last week. Me and Chris mentioned Roger Schmidt had effectively been sacked after a dismal run of form. So can you just explain who the new Leverkusen coach is and why people are surprised that he's been brought in at the Bayer Arena?
Sure. So this is Tayfun Korkut, who is actually on the same coaching course as quite a few other coaches who have made it into the Bundesliga already. Markus Feinsiel, for example, the coach of Schalke, was on the same coaching course as Korkut a few years back. This coaching course, which is done in Cologne, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, is renowned because it produced six different coaches who went on to coach in the Bundesliga, which is quite astounding. However, Korkut's coaching career so far hasn't exactly gone to plan. You look at how he did at Hannover, where he was coaching in the Bundesliga, and that didn't go all that well. He lost his job there with a few games left in the season. Hannover just about survived thanks to back-to-back wins, but that wasn't seen as the greatest job of all time. And then, earlier this season, he was at Kaiserslautern, a massive club in the second division, won the Bundesliga back in 1997, it would have been. And I think you might have heard of them referred to as being the German Leicester, in the same way that obviously that everything needs to be contextualized with being compared to Leicester City these days. They were 13th in the table at Christmas when he got the boot. So that managerial CV in the last few years doesn't exactly scream, I should be taking over at the club with the third biggest budget in the Bundesliga. So it is a surprise decision, but I think that his coaching ability probably speaks more for that. Sometimes results don't go your way. We saw that with maybe André Schubert in the first place at Borussia Mönchengladbach, because before then, he'd been at a second division club at St. Pauli and had a really bad start to the season a few seasons back, but went away. Managed to get some more experience under his belt with the Germany at Germany youth level, and then became the Gladbach second team coach, and then was given his opportunity with the first team. So it's not all that much of a shock to see this kind of move happen, but I think it's still from English eyes, it's still a little bit weird to see somebody who failed so recently in the second division be given a chance till the end of the season, even if I think that Leverkusen are looking at this going, well, what do we have to lose by appointing Korkut?
The feeling I got around the club, speaking to a couple of fans of being in that stadium, is that things at Leverkusen are very flat. And I wonder, I mean, the fact that Korkut might be a stopgap has been mentioned. Do you think Leverkusen will try and go for a big name in the summer to excite the fans once again? Because they certainly seem to have the players, particularly young players at Bayer.
Undoubtedly will they go for another name. I would be stunned unless Tayfun Korkut manages seven back-to-back wins to get them into the Champions League, which I don't think is going to be possible because they are, as it stands, 11 points off the top four with 10 games to play. They did have an exceptional run towards the end of last season. But I think, as you say, the feeling that you describe there at the Bayer Arena of it being flat, that's the same feeling that I've got there when I've been for a few of their home games so far in 2017. Things just don't seem quite right. And their home form, which has been poor this season, I don't think that's exactly helped things at all. But they've had it's been weird. Going forward, they've been so poor. I remember watching them against Mainz a few weeks ago, and I was a little bit shocked, actually, that Roger Schmidt didn't get sacked after that game and that they waited and persisted and with the mauling that they then took at Borussia Dortmund. Because you look at the attacking quality in that squad. OK, they are missing Hakan Çalhanoğlu, but I don't think that they're missing single players like Bellarabi for the first half of the season was used as something as an excuse for why they underperformed. That's not enough. You look at the players that they have going forward. You look at Karim Bellarabi. He is one, but he's back fit now, and he's not exactly carrying the team. Well, it's impossible to carry this whole team. You've got Chicharito. You have Calhanoglu, or you had Calhanoglu in the first half of the season. You have Kevin Folland, Julian Brandt, Kai Havertz, who is a teenage sensation who will go on to become quite something, I think. Like, there are more players within that as well. And it was just not clicking under Roger Schmidt. And I think that there had been no real evolution since he took over in 2014. And I think that that's ultimately what cost him. And now Leverkusen are even in a position where if they don't pick up their form soon enough, the relegation playoff spot is only 5 points behind them right now. And they will need to start looking over their shoulder, because Hamburg and Werder Bremen, and as the surprise tone of my voice probably betrays, are actually starting to win games, which is bizarre.
Yeah, Hamburg getting more crucial points at the weekend. A big story out of Germany over the past few days, Archie, has been the announcement that Xabi Alonso will retire at the end of this season. Of course, spent the last few years at Bayern. This wasn't really a surprise. This was something that was rumoured, I want to say, a month or a couple of months ago.
Yeah, when he signed a new deal, it was announced with a couple of other players, and notably it was as well, because his contract was a little shorter than the others. And I think that he's done a very good job for Bayern Munich. He's not a player who's ever really been renowned for his pace, but his ability to pull the strings from that deep position, as he did so memorably for Liverpool and indeed for Real Madrid. I don't think he's as complete a player, for example, as Toni Kroos. I actually think that Bayern would have probably done better to keep Kroos and not buy Alonso in the long term. But I still think that Alonso has done a very good job there. Alonso, speaking last week, was saying that he'd rather retire too early than it be too late. And I think that actually he's making a very wise move indeed. And I think that fans of particularly of Liverpool and Bayern Munich will be able to look back on some memorable goals that he scored. I say memorable in terms of long range efforts, because I think Liverpool fans will remember those goals he scored against Newcastle and Luton from his own half. And for Bayern Munich, he scored some cracking goals as well from outside the area. He scored in the opening game of the season against Werder Bremen. And last season, he scored this wonderful volley against Darmstadt, which was quite something to behold. So I think that fans will certainly miss, and I will certainly miss seeing him tee off from long range.
Yeah, one of my favourite midfielders ever, Xabi Alonso. He didn't play in Bayern's 3-0 win over Frankfurt at the weekend. He was in the crowd with his family. Frankfurt suffering since the turn of the year. 3-0 win for Bayern. Mats Hummels with a brilliant sliding tackle, if you haven't seen that, to deny a goal for Hergotta, I think it was. We'll put that on our Twitter feed. And it looks like Bayern are running away with it now, Archie, because Leipzig lost again at the weekend, this time at home to Wolfsburg.
Yes, 10 points now between Bayern Munich and RB Leipzig. Last season, at this same stage, there was only 5 points between Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, which is strange because the Bundesliga has looked so competitive in terms of that title race for the majority of the season, such as the way that Leipzig have been playing. But if only Borussia Dortmund had been able to have the season that they had last season this season, because then there would only be 2 points between the top two. And I think that the quality of that Borussia Dortmund side as well far exceeded the current version, albeit if they're improving. To come back to Leipzig, they've really dropped off in the last few weeks. I think that, as Ralf Hasenhüttl said on Saturday afternoon, we are no longer a blank slate, i.e. teams have worked them out that if you let Leipzig have possession and hit them on the counter, as Wolfsburg did against them, as Hoffenheim scored the most brilliant counter-attacking goal against them the other week, even if they went on to lose. But I think Leipzig have been worked out, and it was always perhaps a matter of time, because they weren't your average promoted side as well, because they had a new coach in Ralf Hasenhüttl coming in at the start of the season, and they didn't adhere to the way that Hasenhüttl had played at Ingolstadt. They played much more aggressively in terms of their pressing game than Ingolstadt could, because they had the players too, quite simply. And I think the injuries have started to get to them as well. Emil Forsberg was missing for the first few games of 2017. Yusuf Poulsen is perhaps an underestimated miss as well, because he's only scored one goal this season, which, if you look at the fact that he's a striker, is not all that impressive. But he does offer them something different up front, in that he's a real physical presence. He's just over 1.90 meters. And the fact that he doesn't score many actually doesn't matter, because of what he can actually give the team. And they don't have all that many variable options. And the problem is, when they have these injuries, it means that they can't really play in these other in another manner. And the lack of a plan B is perhaps getting to them somewhat. I still think they're going to qualify for the Champions League, which is still an amazing achievement for a promoted side, even if they do have all this money behind them. But it does look like that they're going to slip away, even if Bayern Munich do have a few more difficult games to come this season.
Worth noting as well that Naby Keita at the weekend suffered a circulatory collapse in the stadium after the Wolfsburg game. The club think it was due to overexertion, to exhaustion almost, from working so hard to try and help turn that game around. He was kept in hospital overnight and they are monitoring him. But for me, absolutely would be in the team of the season for the Bundesliga so far. Archie, let's finish with Hertha against Dortmund. I commentated on this game at the weekend. It was a game that was fairly even. Hertha winning it in the end with a Plattenhardt free kick. But Dortmund, after the high of that Champions League a victory over Benfica, despite Aubameyang scoring his 22nd goal in 22 league games, they falter after a Champions League fixture again.
11 points from 8 games this season after Champions League matches, which I don't even think that this performance against Hertha was one of the worst of those either, but that there is still something very much to be rectified there. And I think it says something as well about the strength and depth of this squad. I mean, this result came about because of two mistakes from Matthias Ginter, ultimately. I think that the first mistake of losing the ball on the halfway line with no one behind you is one thing. To then be done by a step over by Vedad Ibisevic, who is really not the quickest player, I think is perhaps more of a criminal offence. So then he gives away the free kick on the edge of the area, which Plattenhardt scores as well. Marvin Plattenhardt, it should be said, what a set piece specialist he is. I lose count of the amount of free kicks that he scored across the season. I think that's his fourth or fifth now. So Hertha are still within touching distance of a Champions League place, which is mainly off the back of that home form, because they've lost five, and they've lost their last five away games now. If they can pick up their away form, then I think that they will even edge into that final Champions League spot. Hoffenheim and Hertha, I think, are the two runners for that, because I can only see Borussia Dortmund pulling away, such as their home form and the fact that they will play away games which don't come after Champions League weeks in the future. But I think that Dortmund still have issues to sort out defensively, even in that victory against Benfica last week. It wasn't like the Portuguese visitors didn't have chances. And there is something to be rectified there over the summer for Thomas Tuchel.
Best home record in the Bundesliga, Hertha Berlin, and they get themselves a win over Dortmund. Archie, absolute pleasure to have you on the show. You're going to be on the BT European Football Show next Sunday as the German football expert. I can't wait to see that, mate. I'm really excited.
It should be good fun being the other side of the
you're just the voice other side in the distance glass on that show normally, but we're actually going to see your face.
I know. How worrying a prospect that is for the British viewing public.
Archie, let's speak again soon.
Will do. Thanks, Bob. Cheers.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
Big thanks to Archie. As always, Chris Parrott was with me on Football in Europe. Chris, let's talk about Serie A Friday night. Juventus against AC Milan, Juve winning 2-1, and it all booted off big time.
Chaos. Absolute chaos. It was sort of going okay until stoppage time at 1-1. Bonatti had put Juve 1 up, Bakker equalised. Then Sosa was sent off for a second bookable offence. Juve went for the winner and got a controversial, very late penalty. Hit DiCiglio's arm. He wasn't very far away from the ball at all. He was given as a penalty. Dybala scored. And fair to say, Milan were not very happy whatsoever.
Galliani, CEO at AC Milan, actually had to hold back Carlos Bacca on the side of the pitch as he went for the referee. It wasn't a penalty. I don't think it was a penalty. And there's this ongoing conspiracy that Juve are getting all the big calls, Chris, and they're running away with the title in the process.
Yeah, and I think it was frustration because Milan had actually played pretty well, and given that Juve had won 30 home games in Serie A in a row, I think, before that, you know, to get the point would have been almost a historic point.
Yeah.
And yet, they lost 6th out of 6 in Serie A at the Juventus Stadium for Milan. So it was an unsavoury end, but it was an excellent game. And Juve found a way somehow to win. And the top four all won, Rob. So they remain 8 points clear. Roma beat Palermo. Napoli won at home to Crotone. And Inter, this might have been the result of the weekend, 7-1 win over Atalanta.
Yeah, Atalanta are pretty good. I saw them the other week. Yeah. And two players with hat-tricks in that game, in Banega and Icardi. Not bad at all. And this Juve thing rumbles on from the cup game against Napoli. We're going to talk about that around the time of the second leg as well. Worth noting as well, Palermo do have their new president. We'll talk about him more next week because we wanted to talk about two other things from Italy, Chris. One being the Derby della Laterna, the derby between Genoa and Sampdoria. First, Roberto Donadoni under pressure at Bologna, and it seems the fans are not very happy there. People remember Donadoni, they don't know him as a manager, in particular as a player with the Italian national team.
Yeah, fans boycotted the away game at Sassuolo, which they won, having been on an awful run. Remember they lost 7-1 to Napoli, February the 4th?
Yeah, yeah.
They got 1 point since then, up until the weekend, and actually a big win for Bologna. You know, Donadoni came in, I think, last season, started really, really well. They're 14th in the table, but they've just been on this awful run. And there's another story we spoke about, Verratti and Matuidi allegedly out at a nightclub. There's a story that 4 Bologna players were, and the club said to be furious at the situation and potential ramifications of that. So, yeah, things not happy at Bologna. By the way, you could easily be out in Bologna until 1:30 a.m. Lovely place.
Oh, so you're sympathising with them. It wasn't the day before the game, though, was it, against Sassuolo?
No, it wasn't. And actually, it was a couple of days before and they didn't miss any training. But I think it's just, if, you know, I think this for footballers, look, you have to understand, if you're on an awful run like that, don't be spotted at a nightclub at 1:30 a.m. Just put your head down, try and improve results. And, you know, if you're winning, no one will mind. But if you're losing, it's not the best place to be spotted.
Okay, Derby della Laterna. Chris, I had a chance to go to this. Do you remember last year, my girlfriend Cheryl bought me a ticket to a Juventus game and we went to Turin?
Yes.
And the next day, yeah, it was Genoa-Sampdoria. And I said, can we just go down there? And she said, no, we can't. We're not going to a second game. We actually need to have a holiday. So I'm gutted that I've still not been to this because it's one of the derbies in Italy.
Oh, it is. I think it would have been quite the atmosphere for you two to have gone for a lovely romantic evening to. it sounds more romantic, the Derby della Laterna, than it possibly is in the stands. Yes, it's a huge derby between, you know, Genoa's a big, passionate port city, and football runs in its veins. And therefore, when the two big teams, of which Genoa were formed first and Sampdoria, are these upstarts who have subsequently been more successful, it's a great game. Samp won 1-0 away, albeit in the same stadium. Another goal from Luis Muriel, and they celebrated like they'd won the cup. Basically, it was a good game. The atmosphere is always, you know, Adam Summerton is often mentioning to this in person and on various social medias. It is a brilliant derby, named by the way. After the ancient landmark and the main lighthouse for the city's port. There we go.
Which is called the Torre. Nicely done. There's some knowledge for your listeners.
There's some knowledge, and there's my terrible Italian pronunciation as well.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Luis Muriel, as well, the man who scored the winner, has promised to deliver for a long time for Sampdoria. Do they think they're going to be able to keep hold of him?
Conflicting opinions. Marco Giampaolo, the coach, says he's almost certain that he's going to leave. The president, Massimo Ferrero, I think is indicating that he believes he may as well, that someone with more financial power is going to come in and pick him up. And then the director, Antonio Rume, was giving the more party line when he said, we're talking about a contract renewal. Muriel is a fantastic player. unfortunately for Samp, if one of the big boys in Italy, or if somebody else in Europe comes in, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to, you know, for him to stay. 10 goals this season, including the winner. Whatever happens, I think he'll leave Sampdoria, given that he's, you know, Derby heroes tend to do that across the globe. So a great weekend for him and Sampdoria.
OK, more from Chris shortly. First, let's speak to Mark Rodden, who's going to explain to you, get ready to focus on how the Belgian League playoff system works.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Okay, joining us now is European football journalist and commentator Mark Rodden. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem, Rob.
Okay, Mark, let's talk about Belgium because that's the main reason we've got you on the show this week. The regular season as we know it, this 16-team league, we've reached 30 games and we're now going into the playoff system. Tommy C has tweeted in, Tom Cheatham, to say, Mouscron staying up in Belgium on the final day was his highlight of the weekend. He says, well, kind of staying up is how he's put it. He says, who knows exactly what happens next? So this is the annual Mark Rodden Belgian Pro League explainer. Could you explain what happens in the league from this point? So everyone's played everyone twice.
Yes.
So break it down, please.
That's the simple part, isn't it?
Everyone's played everyone twice. Don't have a go. Exactly. I'm setting you up.
Exactly. So top six play each other home and away after the cup final. Zulte Waregem against KV Oostende next weekend. So there's a break for the rest of the teams. Then it's the championship playoffs. And then the teams from 7th to 15th will join three teams from the second division, first division 1B as it's called, who will play sort of mid-table playoffs, two groups of six. The group winners play each other, and then the winner of that match will play a team from the top six for a place in the Europa League next season. So Mouscron are safe, and unlike, was it Westerlo last season? I think, yeah, it was Westerlo stayed up on the last day last season and finished 15th. I remember talking to you about it.
Yeah.
Last year, Westerlo saved themselves on the last day of the regular season and then didn't have a match while every other team in Belgium continued playing. Unlike last season, they changed that, and now Mouscron will be involved in that crazy mid-table playoffs that also involves three second division teams, one of whom has just lost a promotion playoff for Ossolara, Antwerp winning on Saturday to get promoted. So the oldest team in Belgium will be back in the top flight next season.
So Westerlo now don't play until August.
No, that was,
they're done.
They're done. Yeah, that's punishment. You know, they were rewarded last season.
5 month holiday.
and this season they're being punished for tragically getting relegated on the last day. Mouscron is very funny. They won, or not funny, it was very strange. They won the last two games, one of which was against Standard Liège, who've missed out on the top six playoffs for the second year in a row. And Standard's punishment for losing to Mouscron 2 weeks ago was their manager getting them in every day to train three times, which I'm sure the players loved. The big team, Standard and Genk, missing out on the top six playoffs. Genk have had quite a week, you know. Beat then league leaders Club Brugge last weekend, hammered Gent 5-2 in the Europa League.
Yeah, why? Yeah.
Hammered Westerlo 4-0 at the weekend and still missed out on the on the top six playoffs.
Okay, so the top six now play for the title. Anderlecht, Club Brugge, Waregem, Gent, Oostende and Sporting Charleroi. Do the points get halved yet?
They do, yes.
So everyone's points get split in half, but Anderlecht have 61. So what happens?
Yeah.
Do they just round it up?
They round it up, yeah.
Oh, dear Lord. What...
I'm trying to remember from last season if they rounded up or rounded down.
They must, because you would feel that would mean you draw a game and then you just completely lose that. You completely
lose that, right?
Okay, so we've got six teams playing it for the title. Then we have all these other teams playing for the Europa League.
Yeah.
One team's relegated. Everyone's points gets halved. And now everyone plays each other again twice in their groups.
It's only the top six. The mid-table playoffs, the groups, they start with 0 points. But the top six points are halved. And yes,
That'd be stupid.
It, 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 It is halved in the top six. Oh, sorry, it is rounded up. So Anderlecht actually nipped in and Club Bruges to first place at the end of the regular season. Club Bruges threw away 2 points at home to Saint-Truiden, 2-2 draw. Anderlecht absolutely scoring goals for fun.
Do you like this system, Mark, that they have in Belgium? Like, does it make it more exciting?
I saw Anderlecht's defender, Uroš Bahić, who's playing his first season in Belgium, kind of after yesterday, just said, I don't get it. This halving of points, I don't get it. So, I mean, the players themselves are confused as well. To be honest, I have a theory that it does help, at least the top six, anyway, put it that way.
A random team can win the league from now on in, can't they? It doesn't... I mean, if everyone's points halved, there's 11 points between Charleroi and Anderlecht, first to sixth, and now that's five or six.
Yeah,
suddenly
the
gap's a lot closer.
I know Standard Liège were a bit unhappy. Their supporters, 3 or 4 years ago, they won the regular season, ended up losing in the playoffs. But it's the playoffs, you know. It's like the championship in England. You know the rules. But I love it. I think it makes for a great title race, you know.
Well, there's one player as well I wanted to ask you about, Mark, and that is Youri Tielemans, who for a long time has promised to become a great player, but he's still only 19. I mean, he must have been in that Anderlecht team since, I want to say, 16 years of age. 12 goals this season. He's scoring a load of bangers as well from long range. Are we starting to see the player that has been promised for some time now in Anderlecht midfielder Youri Tielemans?
Absolutely. Unusually, didn't score 100-kilometre-an-hour goal at the weekend. 17 goals in all competitions. He's really flourished. 8 assists in the league as well. He's flourished under René Weiler, who came in from Nuremberg, almost got them promoted to the German top flight last season. Real kind of left-field appointments, and there were question marks at the start of the season about him, but Anderlecht just so much more exciting to watch under him compared to Besnikhazy last season. And as well, has he kind of favoured Stephen Dufour over Tielemans, not necessarily in the starting 11, but in terms of giving him more priority. And he's the guy who's got to be, you know, he's the captain. He's got to be, you know, the team has got to suit him. Whereas Tielemans is just absolutely loving life in this really attacking side. They've got Łukasz Teodorczyk up front on loan from Dynamo Kiev. He got his 20th goal of the season, 27 in all competitions, 7 in the Europa League. Nikolaj Stanciu, Sofyan Hani, Alexander Kikchu, all these attacking players, and they're allowing Tielemans to flourish.
Well, Alexandru Macheu tweeted in to talk about the Romanian contingent at Anderlecht as well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because you've got, to finish on Tielemans, he's, believe it or not, biggest outgoing transfer in Belgium in history was Marouan Fellaini, €21.75 million to Everton in 2008. Tielemans is going to smash that. Anderlecht are looking for 30. Atletico Madrid, Sevilla, Dortmund, the clubs mentioned. He says he doesn't want to cut corners, so he doesn't want to go to a team where he's not going to play. So he's going to leave in the summer, without a doubt. By the same token, Nikolaj Stanciu has come in as Anderlecht's record signing, €9.8 million if they get to the Champions League, which is pretty much guaranteed at this stage. He's 23. You know, he took a long time to get going, and it's understandable, really, because, you know, he's a guy from a rural part of Romania, actually only really started playing football at a proper level at about the age of 11, had a bad injury, knee injury at the age of 15, you know, but he is starting to come into some good form, you know, 4 goals in the league before in the Europa League as well, got the winner against Apoel Anderlecht. Looking good to make the last 8, having won that first leg away from home. And the other guy, Kipchu, 27, eight assists in the league as well, just a really hard runner. A Romanian TV channel has bought the rights, you know, immediately when those two signed, they bought the rights for every Anderlecht game this season, which is understandable, I guess. And since then, both Club Bruges and Standard Liège have signed Romanians, so they're all trying to cash in, I guess, on this new fad of Romanian players, because, you know, they're very good. You know, they've come in and they've done really well, and Stanciu and Kipchu are really, really good players to watch. So hopefully the guys at Club Bruges and Standard Liège will do well too.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on and explaining the most complicated league in Europe.
Yes. Well, I can have another go another week as well.
No, I don't think anyone ever wants to hear that again.
when the new system becomes a little bit clearer for the mid-table playoffs, so, you know, it'll be very exciting when, you know, a second division team is leading one of those groups, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, Mark, we'll get you on before the end of the season. Thank you so much for coming on again.
Lovely. No problem, Rob.
For more, head to the website, footballineurope.co.uk.
Okay, Chris Parrott is with me for the final part of the show. Chris, it's been a bumper show, and we haven't even touched upon the fact that Barcelona, after beating Paris Saint-Germain and giving a new contract to Ivan Rakitic, meaning he probably won't be leaving for Manchester City, they went and lost to relegation-threatened Deportivo La Coruña.
Yeah, they did. Talk about after the Lord Mayor's show, 2-1 defeat. Away from home, Pepe Mel, now in charge at Deportivo. Huge win for him. He's only been there for a couple of weeks. Luis Suarez scored, but for the first time, as one of the listeners mentioned, was on the losing side for Barcelona. And wonderful week, because they're unexpectedly through and are now the bookmakers' favourites to win the Champions League. But in terms of La Liga, which was looking like the main trophy they were fighting for, they have lost top spot. They're now 2 points behind Real Madrid, who have played one game less. So a damaging weekend for Barcelona after a brilliant couple of days before that.
I mean, Real Madrid didn't have the most comfortable weekend victory. Do you want to break down what happened with them?
Yeah, they just about squeezed past Real Betis. They went behind, Ronaldo equalised, and then guess what happened? Sergio Ramos with a towering header.
It was a brilliant header as well. Apparently Cruz has made something like 5 or 7 goals for Ramos this season.
Has he? And actually, Ramos was pretty poor defensively in that game. But, I mean, when his career comes to an end, and in 50, 60 years, you're going to be watching videos of Ramos. And he will be one of Real Madrid's greatest ever players, I have no doubt.
I saw Joe Casanelli, friend of the show and the Times Spanish football writer, tweeted, maybe if Ramos played up front and not at centre-back, they would score more and concede less.
Yeah, I mean, Morata started, didn't really take his opportunity. And Keylor Navas.
Let's talk about him.
A lot of talk. So he had a nightmare few minutes, basically. He should have been sent off. He wasn't. And then he fumbled.
Player threw on goal that he basically smashed into.
Exactly. And then he sort of bizarrely fumbled the ball, looked like he'd saved it, and then just let it, you know, somehow the ball went in.
No, it's terrible, yeah.
It is, and it's not the first time. I'll come back to that. Jovetic winner for Sevilla when, you know, he was way out of position. He was magnificent last season. There's no denying that, but I think this season, and given that there are some extremely, I think in world football we are blessed right now with the standard of goalkeeping. Real Madrid always strive to be the very best, to have the very biggest names. You just think next season, and you know, Chelsea and Manchester United fans, Courtois and De Gea, I am sure, will be pretty high.
Oh, so you're saying this might you don't think. Are you saying he was so good last year, Chris? You don't think he's good enough for Real Madrid now?
I think
to be number one.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think if I was looking at the Real Madrid team and thinking where can we improve, goalkeeper would be pretty high on my list. I think if you look around the other top teams in Europe, you know, Bayern have Neuer, Barcelona
Juve
have
Buffon,
Ter Stegen, De Gea, Buffon, Courtois. I think you can name. You can probably name 7-8 players who are a better goalkeeper than Keylor Navas, which is fine if we were talking about a Sevilla or a, you know, even a Paris Saint-Germain or someone. But we're not. We're talking about Real Madrid here, and I can see that. Well, we know they're thoroughly interested in David De Gea. I think Courtois has inferred that he wouldn't mind playing back in Madrid after that great spell he had at Atletico. I think that might be one too many mistakes. He said. Interesting post-match, you know, he's a very likeable guy, Keylor Navas, he said, I've promised to my teammates that I'm not going to make another mistake. And you sort of think, you can't do that. You're a goalkeeper, unfortunately. You probably are going to.
Oh, it makes me sad. That made me sad in my stomach.
I know, exactly. I read it and I was like, no, don't say that,
Keylor. Don't say that, Keylor. Okay, elsewhere in La Liga at the weekend, Sevilla drew with Leganes. They're 5 points behind Madrid. Suspect they're out of the title race now. They did have Escudero, Ibora and Ndonzi on the bench ahead of facing Leicester in the Champions League. Let's talk about Russia, Chris. You commentated on Spartak at the weekend. Yes. And they're getting close to wrapping up the title because Zenit lost to Amkar. So tell us a little bit about Spartak's state of affairs at the moment.
So they've gone from a club in turmoil and a bit of a national joke figure.
In August,
they lost to AEK Larnaca. They sacked their coach, their assistant at the time, Massimo Carrera, who had, first of all, they went through, everyone thought Kurban Badaev was going to go there from Rostov. It didn't happen. And Massimo Carrera, Antonio Conte's assistant for Italy at Euro, has come in and he has turned around the biggest club in Russian football in the space of 5-6 months. Just remember, they won 9 of the first 10 titles after the breakup of the Soviet Union. After the last of those triumphs, Rob, 16 years has passed and they have not won another title. This is like Manchester United of, you know, imagine United were finishing 5th and 6th. It would be the equivalent in Russia. And they have been outstanding this season. They weren't actually great yesterday. They won the game thanks to Samedov, who re-signed for the club, and 12 years after signing his... after scoring his last goal for Spartak, he got the only goal against Anchi. And as you mentioned, 8 points clear. And that first title since 2001 now, it really is theirs to lose. I'd be very surprised. They have such a team spirit now, which if you've watched them over the last couple of years, you would not believe this is a Spartak. This is a side famous for infighting. And yet Massimo Carrera has gone in there and has got this team spirit and a way of playing. I tell you what, if you're looking, I don't want him to leave Russia or Spartak, but he has done a phenomenal job.
Yeah, a former assistant to Conte. I mean, him and Conte might both be picking up league titles come May. But an interesting story with Anji, Chris, who Spartak were playing. So Anji were the team a few years ago who invested a lot of money in the likes of Roberto Carlos and Samuel Eto'o, probably the two biggest club names that they've ever signed. They dropped a lot of their spending. They were relegated. They're back up. But they've had the weirdest winter transfer window, I think, of any club in Europe. Do you want to break this down for us?
Yeah, definitely. So, Anchi, remember, were a club who came from nowhere under the bankroll by Suleiman Kerimov. As you mentioned, those guys there, they never quite won the title, but they were in Europe. He
beat Liverpool at home, even in European competition.
Beat Liverpool at home, exactly. You know, played in Dagestan and a lot when it was, you know, it's a volatile region of Russia, and you know, a lot of their players were living in Moscow and flying. It was, you know, it was an uneasy situation. So Kerimov, having bankrolled the club, sold up in the winter break. They changed manager. Alexander Grigorian came in. They changed their entire playing staff, bar about two players.
Okay,
Middle of the season. They lost more than 20 players. Gabriel Obertan left to Wigan. Bolli went to China. And the new owner said, we're going to build a team full of Russian and Dagestan-based players. So mid-season, they lose their owner, their coach, and their entire playing squad. Good luck, Grigorian. They're 11th in the table. They've had to beg, steal and borrow players, and yesterday or on Sunday they were magnificent.
they played
like a team. They attacked, which not many Russian teams do away at the big sides. They were a breath of fresh air, with loads of guys who have basically been given a second chance to shine in the Russian Premier League, having played, you know, having been at other sides and not played, or having been in the second tier and given their opportunity. It's remarkable. Absolutely nightmare to research, but just extraordinary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're just going to have debutants every week, basically, between now and the end of the season. And they lost, but they deserve a lot of credit. But There's a lot of great stories in Russia this season, and Spartak and Antsy are probably two of the biggest ones.
Okay, well, let's finish with a story from Russia as well, because Rostov take on Manchester United in the Europa League on Thursday. 1-1 from the first leg in Russia. Chris, you commentated on the first leg. We're away for your stag do for the second leg. So you won't be doing that one at Old Trafford. But let's have some thoughts. Are Manchester United going to get past Rostov? They do have that away goal.
They do. Yes, I think is the answer. And also, that the game was a farce, Rob. I think a lot of people before were thinking...
That pitch.
Oh, this is Jose Mourinho complaining about pitch. That pitch wasn't suitable to play football on for either side. As soon as you see Ander Herrera, you know, turning around and just lobbing the ball 20, 30 yards up the pitch, it was not conducive to a game of football whatsoever. And it's a shame, really. I was commentating on the game with Sammy McElroy, and I asked him afterwards, like, was that what football was like in the 70s? And he went, yep, that's exactly what it was like in the 70s. And poor old Antsy, poor old Rostov got Antsy on the brain. They've actually got some really talented players. They couldn't play football on that pitch either. I think United got a very professional job. And by the way, this is why Jose Mourinho wins, Rob, because, okay, they're Manchester United, they're away at a very small side in Rostov, in terms of their history anyway. Yeah, they've been brilliant recently. But was he arrogant enough to say, no, we're United, we're going to play the way we want to play? No, he matched Rostov's formation. He knew. Just get in, get out with a positive result, and then win the two-legged tie.
They'll knock them out, will they?
Yeah, they will. But do you know what I mean? I'm just saying, I know a lot of, not a... I know a lot of other coaches who would have gone there and sort of, we'll play our own game, we'll beat them, and probably would have lost. But they didn't. And yeah, they will. I'm sure they'll beat them. And just one other thing, because between now and the World Cup, any slight bit of Russian hooliganism is going to get huge news, owing to what happened, those terrible scenes in the summer. Worth noting that Rostov fans gave Manchester United blankets that made the trip. And it was all, they were welcomed in rather wonderfully. So I think we should report both sides of these things when it happens. And the welcome that Manchester United got in Russia from the supporters was exemplary.
Chris, I think that's all we have time for. And we will try and piece ourselves back together for next Monday's podcast. That's going to be awful, isn't it? Monday's podcast is not going to be that good, is it?
I would be surprised. Unless we just carried on and we could start drinking in the morning and record it in the afternoon. That'd be really fun
not
for us,
idea.
Probably not for the listeners.
Well, if download it still. We're not telling you not to. Tweet us at FIA Podcast. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. Chris, see you very soon, mate.
See you very soon.
This is Football in Europe.